four programmers from Atari decided to start their own company, as you all know, and that company was Activision. For the first time at CG, we're proud to have the four founding members of Activision, David Crane, Alan Miller, Bob Whitehead, and Larry Kaplan. Hey, we're not done yet. In addition, as far as I know, Activision was the first company to have the first team of siblings programming for them. And we have two-thirds of the sibling team, Gary Kitchen, and making his CG debut, Dan Kitchen. So it's my pleasure to introduce the Activision people.
Go ahead, Gary. Ask the question.
How many of you have come to past shows and seen this panel where the Activision guys have spoken?
What do you want to hear?
We have to know whether or not we're going to repeat stories is what it comes down to. There's a lot of stories. We don't want to bore everybody. So it doesn't look like there's really that many people who've been here in the past and seen the Activision guys talk. So I think you got a free reign, Dave.
We can tell all the same old stories.
But we'll try to embellish with some new ones as well. I actually think we should focus on the 25th anniversary of Activision, so a lot of it should be about the founding of the company. That gets me off the hook.
It Dave?
Not quite.
So, all right. Yeah, let's see. In about 1977, I joined Atari, and the two guys on my right and left here were already working there. You had been there since 76? And same with you, or you were early?
I joined 2/22/77.
Okay. I was in, the fall, something like that.
I was about a month ahead of Al.
Yeah. So it just happened that for some reason the four of us tended to hit it off, and we kind of worked together on a lot of projects. Remember that in those days, it was one man, one project. And, we have 40, 60, 80 man teams now doing video games. And at the time, each one of us was responsible for the project from start to finish. We would come up with some concept, get peer approval generally. I mean, we were going to do whatever we were going to do as far as management was concerned, but the rest of us had to kind of think, yeah, that's probably a good idea, go for it, But after that point, we came up with a game concept, drew every little pixel of art, made every line of programming, every bit of sound effects that existed. And, so it was one man, one project. But we found a synergy among the four of us, and we always went out to lunch together and whatever, and would talk about the games, play each other's games. So it became kind of a nice group working environment where everybody was helping everybody else, even though it was one man's responsibility. So because of that synergy, when we were talking about where we were going to go next, having some problems at Atari, and they kind of pushed us out the door, actually, we ended up going out together. So that's why the four of us were the guys who started Activision. You want to tell the story with meeting with a lawyer or anything?
Sure. How did this all start? Larry, Dave, and I got assigned to develop the operating system for the Atari 400-800 in late 1978.
Late 78.
So we spent about 6 months doing that, and at the same time we weren't doing VCS carts. At the end of that time, I was sort of reassessing what I wanted to do at Atari. And one thing I wanted to do was to get recognition for my work. Just like every other entertainment developer in the world gets at least recognition, their name on the product for how they contributed. And I approached management about that opportunity, and Dave and Larry and Bob joined me a little bit later in that effort. But ultimately, Atari said, no. No recognition. So, and that was pretty much the end of my time there. One of our other co-workers at Atari, Joe DeCure, who was extremely important in the design of both the Atari VCS and the 400-800, had just left with relatively little fanfare to start his own company, and I asked him what attorney he had used to form his company. And he told me, and so we called up Wilson Sonsini, now a very prominent law firm here in the area, set up a meeting. The four of us went there, talked to them about incorporation, raising money, and that's sort of how the things started to snowball. One of the first things they told us was that we would have to have an experienced management person involved in order to raise capital. And after a few weeks, they put us in touch with Jim Levy, whom we developed a working relationship with, and he joined us in our effort to start what ultimately became Activision.
The one thing that you skipped over was our meeting with Ray Kassar while we were at Atari.
Please.
When we went in, and that when it was right before where Al said, and they said, no. Well, how we got there was, we went in and we said, you know, we ought to have some recognition. We had just been given statistics that circulated through the lab that the games that the four of us did in the previous year had earned Atari $60 million. And we were all making about $30,000 a year. And, you know, we said, you know, come on, give us a little piece. And they had promised a piece and then, you know, didn't deliver and that sort of thing. So finally we went right to the president. And he basically looked at us and he said, well, you know, you guys are important to the development of video games, but so is the guy on the assembly line who puts them together. And in essence said, you're no more important than the guy who builds them, so good luck in your next venture. Pretty much what they said.
And of course, the famous towel designer remark.
there is that. Yeah, he came out in the lab. He made that one in the lab public, right?
No, he made that just...
That was just in our meeting, yeah. He said, well, I understand you guys. I mean, you're creative people. I used to work for Burlington Industries, and I worked with towel designers. So I understand you technically. You're creative people.
He said we're a dime a dozen.
Dime a dozen. Yeah.
You may think you're creative and worth your certain, but you're just a dime a dozen. So remember, that programmers are a dime a dozen. Right.
After we left, there were other rumblings at Atari, and the local newspaper, the Mercury, interviewed Kassar at some point. Ray Kassar was the CEO at Atari. And unfortunately for him, he used the phrase having to work with a lot of high-strung prima donnas. Now, this is after we had left, but still, I'm told that the next week that a T-shirt showed up in the design group that said, just another high-strung prima donna at Atari.
I saw one today. Was somebody wearing one of those? Just left. Okay.
So. I want one.
So the management, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do in starting Activision was to work for a company that respected the industry and was capable in working in the industry. And all the signs at Atari were that was declining at Atari. And there seemed to be no way to turn it around. So as Dave said, we were almost forced out of the company.
How many people here remember when the first Atari game came out? I mean, it actually went to the store and bought it. And the first Activision game? I mean, Dan and I were on the East Coast. These guys founded the company on the West Coast. And we were getting into making games at the same time we were fans. And I specifically remember hearing that another company was coming out with games. And prior to Activision, you bought games from the company that made the hardware. I mean, it was Odyssey, you bought Odyssey games. It was Atari, you bought Atari games. And we both remember going to the store and seeing a box for an Atari 2600 game, and it said Activision on it.
Called Skiing.
It was Skiing. And our first response was, what the hell is this? This has got to be crap. It's not from Atari. I mean, that's what you thought. This has got to be garbage. And I remember we brought it home and we plugged it in. And it was such a dramatic difference in quality between every Atari game that had ever come out and that particular game. And you were stunned. It was like, oh, my God, what is this? I didn't know this machine could do this. So it was amazing. We became completely addicted to Bob's Skiing Game. It was the first Activision game that Dan and I become completely addicted to, which is actually a great segue into a story how we joined Activision. And Dan's famous meeting with these designers. We started designing games on the East Coast. I picked up the phone one day. I called Activision, asked for the head of product development, got the guy, told him, we're in the East Coast. We're doing 2600 games. It was a little strange for him to hear that because we didn't come out of Atari. We weren't part of Activision. as far as he knew, there was no 2600 development on the East Coast, but I had back engineered the 2600, so we were starting to write games on the 2600, and I was just finishing Donkey Kong for Coleco at the time. So when I told him that, his ears perked up. He said, what are you guys doing? So we came out and we met with, you know, the gods, these guys, in a room, and to break the ice, they had a 2600 on the table. And Al took out, I guess it was ice hockey, right? Mm-hmm. It was ice hockey, and he put it in, and he kind of looked at us and said, yeah, somebody want to play? You know, it was a two-player game. So Dan, who was the player, grabbed the controller and beat the hell out of Al at ice hockey. And that was it. At that point, we were in. I mean, you know, you can beat the designer. You've got to be pretty damn good. Do you remember that, Al?
Frankly, I don't.
Dan had this tremendous shot.
Conveniently, you've blocked it out.
Shot that he could sneak it by, and you could never understand how that shot went in. But Dan,
prior to that, though, when we were in Gary's basement in New Jersey, we had purchased the skiing game, and the catalog had the four designers always in the back of the catalog. So Gary and I and two other chaps who came with us drew our pictures and put them over those and
right.
stuck it
Scotch
up on the wall and said, within 6 months, we're going to be part of the team. And lo and behold, it actually came.
Right,
came
Dave through. Always enjoyed that little catalog. You saw that little catalog.
I saw that one.
Yeah, that was very fun. So then we ended up joining Activision and starting the East Coast Design Center, which was, I guess, was the first satellite design office.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was very much intentional on our part. We had four guys who worked together really well, and we knew we had to grow the company, but to do that and have a big bunch of people, you know, screwing everything up would have been a real problem. So when you guys surfaced, we thought, this is a great idea. We can hire new guys and keep them 3,000 miles away.
So we don't bother them.
Yeah, well, yeah, and to add to Gary's story is, you know, one of the big selling points, if you're a programmer, pretty much the only input you take seriously is from other programmers. And I think that's something that, you know, I want to communicate to you. That was a selling job. I mean, here we walk into this room, there are garage shops. You know, I think the room was about half the size, about three pieces of furniture, if I remember
right. Right, right.
And they're slobbering all over us. They think we're, like you said, they think we're gods. And, you know, that's really important to programmers. I mean, our experience with management.
Yeah.
Our experience with management is it's not a good one. I, and marketing guys, and it's not to say that we haven't worked with some terrific people, but there's something very powerful about the guy sitting next to you that's your peer when he comes over and gives you some input, it's real input versus, you know, marketing guys coming through and, you know, our favorite phrase is, what was our favorite phrase? I can't remember, but they had, you know, marketing guys have all these really cute phrases, and they walk out and we're, you know, doing the mimic thing and
rolling the eyes.
Yeah, and so that was a selling job. I mean, they were all over us, and clearly we respected their work, and I think that's typically what happens in most team environments, is you get some peer groups around which you respect highly.
And actually, one of the funny stories when we were talking about joining Activision was after I made the call, Tom Lopez, who was the vice president of product development at that point, said, we want to come out and see you guys, like, right away.
We want to come out and see your facility.
We want to see your facility. Yeah. Well, our facility was the basement of my house, and it was my brother and I and John Van Ryzen, who ended up doing Hero, a couple of other games, and a fourth guy. And we said, yeah, sure. And they said, yeah, we're coming out tomorrow or some ridiculous thing. So he comes out with Jim Levy. I mean, it's the president and the vice president of product development come out and ring my doorbell in a little town in New Jersey. And we take them down into the basement, unfinished basement, by the way, and sit them down at one of the little desks so they can see what we're doing on the Atari 2600. And in the middle of this life-changing, important meeting, the doorbell rings, and it's the guy from public service who has to come down in the basement and read the meter.
Yeah.
And we can't tell them to go away, so they have to interrupt the meeting, ask Jim and Tom to move out of the way.
And move the desk.
Move the desk.
Read the
meter. You're in the way of the water meter. You know, get down on your knees, do the water meter thing. It was a little embarrassing. But it worked out all right. We showed them a couple of screens in 2600, and they said, yeah, okay, you know what you're doing.
Gary, did you ever have a chance to meet with the Atari guys?
Yeah, we did. We during the same time, we were playing the field trying to figure it out. So we called the Atari guys and we said, hey, we're do these games and I'm finishing Donkey Kong and maybe we'll think about doing something with you guys. And they said, great. So they sent us first class tickets for the four of us and they flew us all out to the offices, I guess, Sunnyvale at that point?
Sunnyvale, yes.
Yep. And we went in there and they wined and dined us and told us how much money we'd make working for Atari. It was a contract. We were going to do games, get a royalty on them. And big dollar signs, huge dollar signs. But then we met with the Activision guys, and it was much more a synergy, and it was about quality. It wasn't, I mean, there was money there, but it was more about, you know, these guys are the greatest video game designers in the world, and you'll have a chance to work side by side with them, and look at the things we're doing, and look at the things that are coming out, and your stuff looks of good quality too, and it would be a great fit. So we went back to New Jersey and said, money or quality? And it's kind of like a lot of debates about that. And we just liked the feel of the Activision group. It was still a relatively small company. And clearly they had the better games. I mean, if you look side by side. And being young and naive and stupid. I mean, young and naive.
Never stupid.
Never stupid. We went with where we thought the quality was. Because we were afraid that the Atari side was more about maybe grinding games out quickly.
Well, I think the end of the interview with the Atari guys was sitting down with the then VP of product development, who will remain unnamed, who looked at us and said, you know, I could take a bucket of crap and put it in a box, sell 250,000 pieces.
Yeah, that's when we were giving him our quality speech.
And that's when we were telling him how dedicated we are to and passionate to make a game great. And we kind of looked at each other and said, I think we have a meeting next week at Activision.
So then right when we were about to make a decision, Pac-Man came out for Atari. and I called Steve Mayer, who I was dealing with at Atari, and said, we decided to go to Activision. And we called the Activision guys, told them we were going to join. And Steve Mayer said, are you available tomorrow? I'm coming out. So he flew out to New York, and he said, I need you to come to a meeting. And he
took us to the Warner Building.
Yeah, picked me up in New Jersey and took me to the Warner Building. Were you at the meeting? I don't remember.
Yes, and we went to the
top floor of the executive
lunchroom.
Went into a 3,000-square-foot office where Manny Girard, who was the man who was running the division of Atari, a division of Warner that at that point controlled Atari, was sitting there behind this giant desk, you know, bigger than this room. And I had no idea who this guy was, and I didn't have a lot of experience in business or anything. All I knew is he wanted to have a meeting. So Mayer comes in, and Manny Girard's sitting there, and they sit me down in front of Manny Girard. Manny Girard goes, what's it going to take to do this deal? And as naive as I was, I said, I got to be honest with you, I can't work for a company that put out a piece of crap like Pac-Man. And Manny Girard's face just went like... And Mayer grabbed this and threw us out of the office, and the rest is history. We went and worked for Activision. Then I found out later who Manny Girard was, and I said, how did I ever have the nerve to say that?
So that takes us to what, 1983?
Yeah, we joined in June of 82. Can I tell the Larry Kaplan? Am I allowed to tell the Larry Kaplan story?
The Larry Kaplan story.
So he's here to suffer.
We join Activision. We're all thrilled. It's June 1st. We're going to fly out to CES June 3rd and join this new company. We're psyched. We've turned down this big money offer from Atari. We've insulted them and have never survived from that. And we land at the airport, and the Activision has these stretch limos picking up the designers, and we grab the first stretch limo, and we get in. There's Larry Kaplan, Mr. Kaboom, sitting in the seat with us in the limo.
Sitting across from us.
Sitting across from us. And Dan and I are like starstruck still. So limo takes off to go to the hotel, and it's quiet. I'm trying to break the ice, and I said, geez, Larry, it's really fun being here or something. You know, it's a great company. And Larry looks at us and he goes, yeah, it used to be fun until we started hiring all these new people. How is it? Kept my mouth shut the rest of the show. Never said a word.
Quiet trip after that.
Probably haven't seen Larry since that day, until yesterday, right, Larry? But I had to ask his opinion. He doesn't actually remember saying that. But Dan, it took months for Dan and I to get over the
shock. I was crushed.
We were crushed. But then 3 weeks later, they called us and said, are you doing anything next week? We're going to Hawaii. I said, I can clear my schedule. And then we went on the Activision family vacation where we all went to Hawaii. And I said, you know, this isn't a bad job. It's not a bad job. Yep. So now we're in 1982 at that point.
Okay, well, we've skipped a few years, but if there are any questions...
Yeah, why don't we open it up to questions? Because that always leads us down some good paths. Most of them, I think.
Well, let's see. Starting left to right, Al?
Well, let's see. I did... Originally, I was assigned a concept to replicate an Atari coin-op game, which became the surround cartridge. So that was my first one. After that, I selected all of my own concepts to implement. So after surround, I did Hangman, then the Hunt and Score game, then basketball cartridge... And then I was assigned to the 400-800 operating system. And the last thing I did was to make a basketball version for the 400-800, and then I left to start Activision.
Why don't you just for laughs, let's just continue and go through Activision so we can all say what we did.
Okay, if I can remember. We started off, I started checkers, and then tennis, ice hockey, Star Master, Robot Tank, and then Law of the West at Accolade. For the C64, yeah. That's the end of my creative development.
Okay.
I don't know if we have time for Dave's list. We may have to skip Dave.
Well, as Al said, early on at Atari, you know, Atari was a very successful coin-op company, and the primary reason that they made the 2600 programmable is so that it could play both Tank and Pong. You know, they had two games... You know, two cartridges. They didn't have any idea that it was going to be able to do as many things as it did. But they had all these arcade games, and they said, well, we ought to do home versions of the arcade games. So there was a lot of pressure to do those. It was, you know, just kind of a general pressure. I was never assigned a game by then, because I was a little later than you guys. But it was kind of, you know, important. We had these great arcade games, so let's do them. So I did some games that were arcade-like. My first game was Outlaw. I did a slot machine game because I had my mother's one of those little old ladies who likes to play slot machines, so I did one for her. Then Canyon Bomber and Depth Charge were two arcade games that Atari had. You know, those arcade games back then were thousands of dollars. They had dedicated hardware just to do that, and it was quite a coup to put two of them into a 2K 2600 cartridge. So that was Canyon Bomber and Depth Charge. Outlaw, Slot Machine, Canyon Bomber. Is there anything else before the Atari 800? While doing the operating system in the Atari 800, I was kind of concentrating on the graphics side. These guys were having 4 or 5 hour meetings over the I/O control block of the hard disk drive controller, floppy disk drive controller, you know, all this nonsense.
Now that's the fun stuff.
That's fun stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was doing the graphics capability, the line draw routines that you could call from BASIC, all the stuff that you could do on the 800. And I also did a game. It's a little known fact. I did an Outlaw and Howitzer game. And Howitzer was the first game where the result of the play modified the play field. So you'd lob shells and then you'd have these craters and you couldn't walk through the craters and stuff. Does anybody have one of those? All these collectors, we got one.
There we go.
Copy of Outlaw Howitzer back there. So... That was written for the 800. And I think that was the last game for Atari. So at Activision, I had Dragster, Fishing Derby, Laser Blast, Freeway, Grand Prix, Pitfall, Pitfall 2, the Activision Decathlon. Then I think we moved into C64 at that point with Ghostbusters, Transformers. Seems like there might be one more C64. I did a tally recently, and I think, counting all the online games I've done since 1995, I think I just finished my 66th game. But I'm not sure. I mean, that's why it's kind of hard to remember all those. Larry.
And what an act of fault.
So, yeah, Atari, I did Air Sea Battle, which was fabulous. And then Street Racer, which sucks, but... you know, second act, you know. And then Brain Games, because they made us do one for the marketing in their wisdom, came out with a controller. I don't know who came up with a controller, but they wanted a keyboard controller. They said, we had to move into that field. So I did Brain Games, which is like a Simon ripoff that was fair. And then bowling, which, you know, as its only fun part, you got to steer the ball, which, you know.
However, it was the first colored character on a 2600, first color table. Put clothes on them.
That's right. Yeah. Put clothes on them. Yes, because that was your thing. But anyway, so that was 2600 Atari. We then did 400, 800. And I did a thing called Video Easel, which would have been a painting thing, but anyway, it was like a life game, and then you could do like a people saw the RCA studio, it had this like little painting growing thing. It was fun. And they shipped it, I don't know why. Useless thing. And then I did the Super Breakout for the 400, 800.
That was great.
Yeah. Cool. And then Activision, of course, Bridge, which, you know, everybody plays, and then this other game, Kaboom, which, you know, some people play. And that's basically my career. I ended it on Kaboom, so I ended it on a better note.
On a high note.
On a high note.
Yeah.
Actually, I learned something new. You said you were earning $30,000 when you left Atari?
What were you earning?
I'm a little, you know, these Berkeley grads, I get a little extra money.
He was
anyway.
He was DeVry.
Oh, he's DeVry, that's right.
We paid him more because, you know, he was taller than
you. You know, the state grads just aren't.
We got paid by the pound at Atari.
I did say
by the pound of flesh
around
you gave.
30. Larry was actually over 30.
Yeah, yeah.
He had the computer science degree.
Yeah, but I was the second guy hired, and I was under all you guys. I was anyway.
The truth comes out now.
Let's see. Atari, Starship, Casino, Blackjack, Home Run, Football, and Video Chess. And I also converted that to the Video Chess to the 400, 800 just before I left. And then Activision was Boxing, Skiing, Stampede, Chopper Command, and then the last two.
Private Eye
never got released, did it?
It did.
Yes, it did.
Yeah,
it did
get released. That was floating on the lab for years. It's just a prototype.
Yeah.
Yep. And then Hardball.
That went on. That,
huge.
Yeah, but
huge.
We're not supposed to talk about Accolade here.
I'm sorry.
This is Accolade.
This is an Accolade. Yeah. Does everybody know why Activision and Accolade both start with A? Does anybody know that? I will tell you. Because, and is this actually true? At least it's
no,
true.
It's
a rumor.
It's
a good story. Well, you got to start with Atari. And then these guys left Atari and they started Activision, which also starts with A. And the rumor was the reason they did it and they made Activision come before Atari in the alphabet was so that when you went to the CES book, Activision would be listed before Atari.
That's absolutely true.
And it absolutely sounds like a lie until you think about the fact that what spun out of that was Accolade. And then when we left was Absolute.
Yes.
And Acclaim also came out of the same group.
Yes.
So that's why there are a lot of A companies in the game industry, just in case anybody wants to know. It's a little tradition. All right. My first 2600 game, well, I actually started in handheld toys, and I did Bank Shot for Parker Brothers and Wildfire, a pinball game. So a pool game and a pinball game for Parker Brothers. Then I back engineered the 2600. And for a company called U.S. Games, I did Space Jockey, which there are many of out there. Space Jockey's claim to fame, I think, was the first $1.99 cartridge ever. I'm very proud of that fact. I think it was $1.99 with a $2 rebate.
I saw it.
So you could actually make money on it.
I saw it here for more, actually. So it's gone up.
Price has gone up, though. Price has gone up out there. Then I did Donkey Kong for Coleco. There's always a lot of questions about Donkey Kong. Yes, I could have put in the other levels, but no, they wouldn't let me, was the answer. Then I did Keystone Capers when we joined Activision, Pressure Cooker at Activision. Then we switched to the Commodore 64. I did Designer's Pencil and Game Maker, and then that was the end of my Activision career. And that's where we stop. Daniel,
no, we don't have to stop there.
Well, we actually did a lot of work on the Apple back in the old days.
We did.
Days.
That's right. We did some Apple
and,
games.
And then we went to Activision. I worked on Crackpots, Kung Fu Master, did the 2600 version of Dave's Ghostbuster game. And at that point, near the end, we farmed out a lot of work, did Commando for some companies and Crossbow. And a number of other non-Activision Atari 2600 games.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, on 2600, you did wasn't it Tomcat?
Tomcat.
Tomcat's a big 2600 right. game. And what else under the Absolute label on 2600?
Oh, goodness.
We did Pete Rose. Pete Rose baseball.
Tomcat. Title match wrestling.
Pete Rose baseball came with a lottery card in every one.
Yeah, it was great. That's a good license to acquire. And then about a month later, he gets kicked out of baseball.
Yeah, well, it was a gamble getting
that. That would work that well.
So that's
marketing 101.
Wasn't there another 2600 game? Actually, Dave, you didn't put that on your list.
What?
The games you did for Absolute under 2600.
Skateboarding, Super Skateboarding.
Skateboarding and Super Skateboarding. You left those off your list.
Well, it was like the first rebirth of the 2600.
It was.
That was like 86, 85.
Yes.
Gary had a relationship with a Toys R Us buyer who was around the corner down the street. And the Toys R Us buyer, he was having lunch with him or whatever, and he said, there's a lot of 2600s out there. I could sell 2600 cartridges.
And we said, you're kidding.
No.
And so they wrote us a deal without the game, right?
They basically
said, we'll buy 15,000. Go make one.
Go make them and we'll buy them. And at one point, during that period of 84, 85,
86. 84, 85, 86.
Yeah. We, with Dave, were the only source of 2600 development in the world. There were only three companies who put out the rebirth of 2600. It was Activision, Atari, and Absolute. And we were doing all the development for all of them. So we would do games like Kung Fu Master for Activision. For Atari, we did
Crossbow Commando.
Crossbow Wrestling, there was a game. And then for Absolute, we had a number of titles. So we had a monopoly on the 2600 development for a couple of years in there because everyone else who had ever done it had gone off and was doing something else
Commodore
in their life.
Or something else.
Yeah, I think a lot of them were out of the video game industry, like real estate agents.
They were. They all became tell designers, actually.
Right. Well. Any other questions? All the way in the back.
How long did it usually take to finish an average
game? A good game or a bad game?
an Activision quality game.
I have to actually say that I don't mean to abuse the guy who did Pac-Man for the Atari 2600 in case he's in the room. Clearly, he probably did not have the time necessary to do the game properly. I mean, at Activision, we were taking 6 to 9 months to do a game. And you heard horror stories out of Atari that they'd whip up a license for E.T. and run in the back and grab the one programmer who wasn't out to lunch and tell him he had 5 weeks to do it. And it was clearly on those machines you couldn't do anything decent in that short a period of time. So a good game, right, Dave, 6 to 9 months, figure?
9 months, 1,000 hours.
At the beginning, it was taking us about 3 months to write a 2K byte game.
Yeah, right. Skiing was 2.5.
Yeah.
Wasn't Pac-Man 2K?
I don't know if Pac-Man was 2K. I think it was 4K, wasn't it?
Pac-Man would have been 4K.
Is Howard Warshaw in the audience?
He's in the back.
No. So Howard did E.T., and I heard that he did it in 6 weeks, which is too much pressure.
Yeah, it's very hard to look at a game and make some sort of a judgment on the programmer being incompetent or not doing a good job unless you know the full story. I mean, those ridiculous schedules, you're backing somebody into a corner. And
we had those at the end.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters Atari 2600 was...
It was a monster.
12 weeks in one day.
Right. It was a monster.
That was a hard one.
And that was so strange when Atari had, I understand they had signed a deal with Spielberg and guaranteed him $18 million off the royalties from E.T. and then to turn around and just give a programmer 6 weeks to implement it, it just made no sense at all. And that's the kind of reasoning why we left Atari.
Yeah, lack of knowledge of the development process and how important it was to have a great game.
Well, and as Gary's pointed out, we did really care about quality. We had at least three that I can remember completely finished video games that when we sat down and played them, they weren't good enough, so they just went on the shelf.
And never went out.
I had one I kept bringing back over and over and over again, trying to figure out, we got to just add a little bit to this and make it fun, and never did.
Which one was that, Dave?
That was
motorcycle?
The motorcycle.
Yeah, motorcycle game.
I had a motorcycle, and so the first thing I did was a drag race-like game, just like Dragster, where you're shifting through this motorcycle trying to get, your fastest speed, so it was really kind of like stupid because you already had Dragster, and everybody said, well, it's kind of stupid. So it was in a beautiful stadium. It was in the first stadium lights with the sunset that ended up in Decathlon.
Yes, which later became Decathlon Stadium.
Later
I remember
Decathlon Stadium. Yeah,
Video Aquarium sort of followed that path. Dave created a beautiful Video Aquarium and tried for the longest time to figure out how to make a game around it.
Fishing derby. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, people would walk into the lab while these fish were just swimming around and become mesmerized, just kind of staring.
It was first screensaver before there were screensavers.
Right. And, in fact, I then made it a fishing game, and I did that with that fishing line, which was a technical achievement. And it still wasn't fun. And it required Bob to step in and make a shark. He took the technology he had used in boxing, which was something new, and made a shark so that it added a little threat. I mean, you had to not only catch the fish, but you had to do it while avoiding the shark. And wouldn't have been a game otherwise.
That became a common phrase in the company after that, you know, when we had a mediocre game concept or game that was trying to be a game. Everybody would say, it needs a shark. Yeah. In all seriousness, I mean, it meant it needs something else.
Yeah. Questions? Up here.
I really like the artwork and that vision of cards. Did you guys have any input on that or anything else about the artwork?
You mean like the packaging?
Yes.
I don't know. Did you guys really have much input on that?
No.
I agree. When you look back on them, I mean, they're very... They really define the era.
Well, let's forget the art. From art's Alan's main thing was that the picture on the front shouldn't be the Atari kind, where there's some. It showed a real tennis player, so he wanted to make sure it was a screenshot.
That's true.
And so there was a period where the boxes only had screenshots because it was like an honest picture. This is really what it's going to look like. And boxing and skiing only had that picture.
Well, they're on the back.
The back of the box.
No, there was some art on the front.
There was some on the front, but
on the back, stylized was a screenshot. In other words.
Yep.
Well, they were faux screenshots, but at least let's show what the game's going to be like. I mean, I remember there was Atari when they put out Breakout, one of the Breakout games. The manual opened up with the phrase, "You're flying through space." And you encounter a multicolored force field. You know, this is what was happening when the marketing people were trying to put a spin.
Marketing got amok.
And so... Yeah, we definitely we had that discussion. We had an argument with Jim Levy over that we really wanted to have real screenshots, something that represented what was really in the game on the back. I'd forgotten about that.
The best thing was the coordinated color. How when you put them all up on a shelf, it was a beautiful image of all the boxes next to each other. They really coordinated nicely.
And that was Jim Levy. I remember walking through a store with Jim, and Atari had just come out with Superman. And they used the Superman logo on the side of the box, and he was appalled because they broke their,
just the line look.
The line look.
Yeah.
Because you could just line them all up, and they all, you know, particular look, but then they had the Superman logo. I kind of liked the Superman logo, but he was a marketing guy, and, you know, he made sure everything looked good.
Over here.
I got a question for Mr. Miller about Star Master. Unique things about this game, because something that made me really wow when I got it back in '83 was the fact that you had to use the one of the controls on the 2600 to toggle between the map and the main playfield. And I'm wondering what if that was just sort of you ran out of functions for the
game. I couldn't figure out any other way to do it. The switches were sitting there. It seemed like a logical thing to do. It was a little bit of a distraction. You had to take your eyes off the screen to find the right switch. But, and just further background on that game concept, we were all working at Atari on the 400, 800, except Bob kept doing 2600 carts. And one of the chip designers named Doug Neubauer created this wonderful Star Raiders game for the 400, 800, even though it wasn't his job. He had finished his real job, and then he was just sort of playing around and created
a great game. Great game in its day.
So everybody in the industry was trying to sort of emulate that concept. And that's where that idea came from. And, you know, it's not like a Nintendo controller. You got one push button. You don't have 18. So that's why I chose to use the console switch.
Next. Right here.
Just a quick question about how much time did you guys spend on the actual concept of the game versus coding?
In this era we're talking about? Because it has changed, but in this era, we had different ways of doing things. What I would do is I'd sit down with the 2600 and figure out some new thing to do with it. I mean, the beauty of the hardware was it was made extremely simple. It was done that way to save money on the chip. And so every place when they were designing the original 2600, before I was there, at every step, they were trying to design the hardware chip, the display chip. They said, if this can be done in software rather than hardware, let's do it in software and take some stuff out of the chip. Make it smaller and smaller and smaller, because size in chips, you know, exponentially and raises the price. So they figured out ways to position objects in software so they didn't have to have position registers in the hardware and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Kept getting smaller and smaller. Well, the serendipity there was that the more functionality you put into the software, into the cartridge, which is the removable part, the more versatile the machine becomes, because you're changing more of the capability, more of the functions in the cartridge than in the hardware. So they got lucky in that respect. They were only doing it as a cost-saving measure. But you've seen, I mean, there are how many thousands of different, you know, Atari cartridges out there, and they all... We came up with new techniques of ways to display things. Here's the, you know, the first, we put a color table on the object, and then you do this, and then you do that, you know. So I would sit down and say, well, what new thing can I do? The Grand Prix car, for example, I was trying to figure out how to make a large object that was colorful and animated. And, you know, made the car. And, of course, once you've got a car and it's a side view of the car, you obviously have to make the road go this way and you drive the, you know. So quite often in my case, a technical innovation drove me in the direction of a game. But everybody else did it. You know, everybody did it differently.
Yeah, when we were at Atari, we'd do something new and invite the hardware designers to come and look at it. And they said, you can't do that. You know, it didn't occur to them that this hardware that they had created was able to do some of these features because so much of the power was in the software. I mean, Dave mentioned it before, but it was never considered that the player objects could be have a color table associated with them, and Larry did that in the bowling game. Or it was never considered that you could use a ball or missile object to create a line like Dave did in Laser Blast. I used it in the hockey game. So we were always coming up with these neat new things that it just wasn't supposed to do. And that extended the life of the hardware considerably, I think.
And once again, it was all driven by us programmers. Almost everything, 99% of the stuff came out straight out of the lab. No focus groups, no marketing input. It was just us guys.
Yeah, the focus group was the other designers. I mean, you try something, you'd show it to the other designers, they'd like it or not like it, and give feedback on it, and that was your focus group. It wasn't putting it in front of kids.
That's something else that we tend to do back in that era is I think we tried to create games that would appeal to a much larger audience than the way I view the industry currently addresses. We would try a lot of different genres, and I think that was healthy in creating much more diverse content. That's something that I think the industry is starting to get back to as casual gaming is opening up through internet delivery of content. There are a lot of... three of us here work for Skyworks, and we create online games for companies, and it's called casual gaming. It's a lot like the kind of games that we used to do back in the old days that are fun to play, quick to play, don't have to study a 400-page manual. I think the retail game business is going to get back to that as internet delivery opens up a much larger audience than the one they've been addressing the last few years.
But why did we do that? Because that's the kind of games we liked.
Yeah.
I mean, Right. Basically, you're going to work on a game for almost a year. You know, you're going to want it to be something you wanted to do. So by the time I was ready to start a new game, I was sick of last year's genre. I mean, I was so tired of space games or whatever that I would noodle around with something completely different, which is great because it's going to take a year before it comes out. So by that time, everybody out there is going to be sick of these things. And so, you know, we just did games we liked. Of course, to Larry, it was just a job.
Right here.
What was the biggest technological innovation to come out of Activision?
DPC.
Oh, no.
Yes. The six-digit kernel?
No, did that come out of Atari? Or was that Activision?
Six-digit kernel.
The six-digit kernel.
It was kind of Bob's beginning of chess.
The only difference between... All right, the six...
Activision.
Do I have to explain this?
You said Activision, though.
I know, but that's why they're asking, did it come out of Atari, or is that an Activision?
What was the first game with a six-digit kernel?
Dragster, the first game.
Okay.
What is a six-digit kernel?
Keep in mind,
the machine is only able to display two objects on a horizontal scan line and a missile or a ball. So you see an Activision game, and you've got these six very high-resolution score digits at the top of the screen. And as a programmer, you look at it and you go, what the hell? How'd they get up there? And I guess it was you, right, Dave? Who wrote this incredibly tight little algorithm that said, all right, I'm going to put one here and one here, and the scan line starts here, and as soon as it reaches here in that microsecond, I'm going to move this one here and move this one here, and then as soon as it reaches here, I'm going to move this one here and this one here. So I'm going to reuse those, and it wasn't exactly like that. They were more interlaced. I'm going to reuse these two objects six times on a line and do it with such precision that I create the illusion of six objects on a line when really it's only supposed to display two. And it was the single most piece of copied code. Everyone in the world who did a 2600 game after that went into Dragster and pulled that code out and said, I want six cool-looking digits at the top of my screen, too. And very few people who pulled it actually understood how it worked.
Yeah, the Magic guys just took it right out of the ROM.
Right, literally took it out of the ROM.
We used to have guys at trade shows come up and say, hey, how did you guys do that?
To help you out, the simple solution was, at Atari, it really started with video chess, where we learned to use the sprites. Basically, this is one line you see on the television, and then we would reuse that sprite and move it by either on the same line sometimes or move that sprite to the next line. So essentially, it was a technology that we advanced moving these sprites around, and it would be moved from line to line, and sometimes in some cases we would use the sprite on the same line. So essentially, that's the technology that was expanded upon.
Those are software techniques. Dave also created something called the display processor chip used in Pitfall 2, which was really a DMA channel device, a really sophisticated device for this pretty simple computer system. I think that's the most sophisticated technology that we created at Activision. It just allows that system to do very much more powerful things than it ever was designed to.
And it went into one game.
Yeah.
Steve Wojda.
Pitfall 2.
I looked at it and I modified it.
Was Plague Attack 8 character?
Well, yeah, no, there were tricks to have other things. Yeah, I actually had done a Keystone Capers 2 game that's never released. It's sitting somewhere in one of those cases out there that we had 8 train wheels. So you could, if you had a little extra time, a little extra cycles, position one or two more objects.
So I used it like in Garfield on the fence.
Okay.
That's on the bottom, and then I modified it to do color change too.
Yeah, I think Steve had teeth. I think he may have had
teeth.
Right. Okay.
One question. How many of you know what we're talking about right now?
Okay. All right. See, this is a very savvy audience.
How many of you do not know what we're talking about? I'm just curious. Okay. Pretty
all right. Let's not get too technical here. Right? Next question.
Well, I just would like to add to that. Probably a lot of you are familiar with Commie Mutants from Outer Space. You ever seen that game? Steve Landrum did a great job, and he created, I think it was an 8-digit score kernel, but they had special hardware in their...
Right.
What was the name of the company?
Starpath.
Yep. Yeah. Starpath Supercharger that allowed them to do some neat new stuff, too.
Yep.
So there was also, you know, talking about two different things, software and hardware. And so software was getting the kernel to be perfect every time, and then they started adding hardware. We went from 2K to 4K. And, of course, with the famous 16K, you know, and 8K and the overlays. And they started adding things like RAM.
I mean, you can only use it for fences and teeth.
Right. Well, I also think the other thing that had to do with bigger than a 6-digit kernel was that a 6-digit kernel was able to do independent graphics in each object.
Right.
If you went more than that, you had to rely on the fact that the graphics stayed the same. Right. Like the teeth, there were multiple teeth, or the fence had multiple rungs, because you didn't have time in the display kernel to change more graphics. So if you knew that a certain number of objects had the same amount of graphics, you could certainly play more games.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yep. John Soule, another you know, there are ex-Activision guys in the audience, as well as the ones that are up here. Peter Kaminsky, John Soule, Matt Hubbard. Where's Matt Hubbard? He's here somewhere. Go ahead, John.
Talk about the corporate culture at Activision. What was it like to work there?
Well, I was on the East Coast, so we had our own corporate culture.
Yeah, but we understand it was really a family atmosphere. I think on Fridays they had barbecues and... Well, that's the propaganda we were fed, actually.
Right, from the West Coast, right?
Well, all right. The thing about the lab culture is we work together and like to work without distractions. So we isolated ourselves from the corporate culture pretty much. So yes, there were family events, and Jim Levy, the president, used to describe it as the Activision family and such, but there was always kind of a division. There was the lab and everybody else. And it wasn't intended that way, but what we did was we took our lab and we started to work in the lab, and we liked to work in a group. We kind of, you know, we'd have an open cubicle environment where if somebody was like this on their keyboard, you didn't even talk to them. You know, you didn't disturb them. But, you know, when you roll back with your joystick and start working on the game or whatever, you're fair game. So everybody would kind of... So you had this nonverbal communication of, leave me alone, I'm busy. Otherwise, you could all chat. But then the phone started ringing, so we had the ringers taken out of the phones and made them flash lights, you know. And all these things, we were trying to eliminate all these distractions, and pretty soon we were in a vault. We were behind magnetically carved, secured doors. And we had a receptionist out front. And, I mean, you had to be a senior vice president to go through that door. And you literally, to get permission, you had to outrank the receptionist, you know, the administrator in our group. And none of that was intended to be a schism, a division. It was for privacy. It was for quiet. Nothing more, because there was a lot going on in that company. I mean, you know, people running around and art people and this and such. So we kind of separated ourselves. And it was really the saddest thing about Activision itself is that need for privacy became to be interpreted as, you know, hushed voices when a designer would walk through the lab.
Oh, you weren't allowed to talk to designers.
Talk to them?
Yeah.
Who are you, you know? And it happened, you know, it was, like I said, it's kind of a sad thing. It happened as a result of we didn't want to have distractions. And there's really good reason. Anybody who programs can tell you, particularly when you're doing video games, it's one of the harder types of programming, because you have to keep maybe 1,000 different details in your mind at one time if you want the end result to come out and have it actually work. Because when you're designing a video game, you're writing the physics algorithms, you're writing, you know, I mean, you're creating a world, and this world has to work. And if you forget that you made an assumption back here, you know, and you're halfway through the game and you'd forgotten about that assumption, it hurts. You have to go back and you're fixing things and such. So there is almost a, I don't know, you want to call it a Zen state. When you're concentrating on this kind of programming, I remember periods of time where I would look up and 6 hours had gone by. I had no idea that period of time had gone by, and I was able to do, you know, 3 weeks worth of work in an afternoon because of that.
Right, and as soon as you're interrupted.
And the phone rings.
That's it.
You're popped right out of that state, and you don't get back in for the rest of the day. So, you know, we wanted to have, you know, keep the distractions to a minimum, and we did. We just ended up with this kind of negative side effect.
And wasn't there probably also another thing that wanted to keep the marketing people out? Really? Because you didn't want to turn into a marketing-driven company where some clown, and I use that word nicely, with an MBA comes in and says, I got a great idea. Broderman made this print thing. Let's do a print thing, and we'll make all these greeting cards. And you're like, get out of here. Let the people who know the games make the games, and
they actually,
not
they actually did. That.
They actually did that product.
I actually wrote it.
That's a real life story.
Yeah, greeting card maker. Yeah,
greeting card maker.
Yeah.
And it was driven by marketing, and it sold what?
Yeah, they took the doors off the lab.
308 units.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, geez, let's go against Print Shop, biggest program ever.
To explain that too is what we just explained sounds very much like a typical Silicon Valley sweatshop, and from the outside,
that's
what it looked like, but all of us couldn't wait to get up in the morning and come to work. It was all consuming. It was, you know, the only reprieve we had was Marie Callender's. That was our social life. You know, that was lunch, and that was an important part. That was an important part of the culture too.
That was every lunch for a year.
Yeah,
and Marie Callender's at Sunnyvale.
Yeah,
until they hired the personal chef. It went along with the limousines and the first class air travel,
right. No,
he's kidding. And all the new people.
All the new people.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, no problem.
Just to put a finer point on the marketing research and such, the problem with marketing research is it's judging what's hot today. And marketing people are going to come in and say, you know, what's really cool today is this game. We should do one of these. And you have to turn around and ask them, is it going to be cool in a year? And that's the something that the marketing people couldn't do that we were doing pretty well. And it's, again, it's not any magical formula or anything. We were just tired of games that were like the ones that are out now. So we would do something new. That's all.
Yeah. Are we almost wrapping up?
Yeah, we've been given the three-minute warning.
Okay. Any more?
Last question, I think. Gentleman in the baseball hat there.
I was wondering who came up with the idea for adding music to Pitfall 2 and how hard it was to compose it and code it in game.
Well, Pitfall 2, again, had a special chip in the cartridge. And we were reaching the limit of what we thought we could do, new techniques for display capability. So I sat down and started envisioning a way to use hardware. I'm an engineer by trade, and in fact, when I was at Atari, nobody knew that. You know, it's like I did only software. They didn't even know I knew how to engineer electronics. But the DPC chip, display processor chip, had a bunch of capability for increasing the art capability, the number of objects you could actually display. Pitfall 2 has all these, you know, bats and birds and all this kind of stuff. It made that possible. But on the side, I thought, you know, the 2600's audio capability is pathetic. It has five notes that are actually chromatic scale notes. And so, you know, it's a different story entirely. You'll have to ask next year with Gary about that one. But
right.
So I came up with a way of having three simultaneously running oscillators combined into a single 4-bit number and fed back to you.
Dave, you're losing them.
I know. So, you know, it was this thing that I was able to do, and because of that, it gave the 2600 three-part harmony plus a drum track, you know, using the noise generator that the 2600 was capable of. So that, if it wasn't for the 2600 or for the DPC chip, there wouldn't have been music. As for putting the music in, it was really very easy, because Pitfall had just been licensed to a Saturday morning cartoon, and they had a theme song. So I, you know, took their theme song that somebody had composed and just keyed it in one note at a time and made it play.
Well, we're out of time now, I'm told. Thank you very much for attending. We enjoyed talking with you about our past.
Thank you for attending, Mr. Wiley. You did a fine job.